Welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm still Uncle Dennis, and there's more important information coming up, so I ask you to keep that pencil and recycled paper handy, just in case you hear something that you want to write down. You never know. Kind of stuff just pops up sometimes. You hear something that you might want to take a note of, so keep that handy. We're going to do commentary tonight. This commentary is entitled The Native Way and was written by Tom Goldtooth, who is the National Director of the Indigenous Environmental Network. The Indigenous Environmental Network is a group of folks who are Native Americans, and we have played Indigenous Environmental Network news here occasionally on Earth First Radio. Let's get into this commentary. Spirituality plays a very important role in our network, as our network does in environmental protection. It frames who we are. I believe that as Native people, we are the land and the land is us. Those of us in the environmental justice movement have started to educate the larger environmental movement that our work protecting the environment is spiritual work. When we talk about the environment, very often we are talking about sacred elements. We're talking about air, which is a gift from the Creator. From the day we're born, we take our first gasp of air, and that's the life giver. Someday that breath of life is going to leave our body, thus completing its cycle. Water is a sacred element. From the time the unborn is swimming around in the womb of its mother, we need water to sustain us. Throughout our lifetime, that water flows through the veins of Mother Earth, remains connected to all life throughout the world. The soil, the earth itself, the skin of Mother Earth is also one of the sacred elements. We have the sun that comes up in the morning every day that gives us warmth, and that gives us understanding. That's the fire, and fire is also very sacred. Some of the prophecies of our various tribes talk about a time when technology and development will be so far out of balance that it may affect the future of our planet. The six nations of the Eastern Great Lakes area have prophecies about the time when the trees will start dying from the top down, and I understand that that's now happening. We've got glaciers in the Andes that are receding. We've got thinned ice in Alaska that is affecting the subsistence culture of the Alaskan natives. I hear that aquifers are starting to dry out. Climate change and global warming are impacting our people. Our elders talk about the spiritual battle that's been going on for a long time. Industrialization has always wanted to control the land and control the people. That's going on today. I believe that globalization is part of that. Globalization places no value in people, no value in religious and spiritual principles, no value in the protection of the commons. Spiritual value ties us to the importance of protecting the Mother Earth, the plants, all animate and inanimate things. When we lose that understanding, industry and development and globalization can do what they want to do, because there are no values behind their structures. Globalization has created a system of corporate ownership above the importance of plants, living things, and humans. Back in the old world, Europe, where there were crusades and inquisitions which did away with earth-based religions, this practice rewrote history. Industrialization further killed off the old world tribes, their identification, their traditional forms of governance, and replaced them with kingdoms and peasants. They've lost their connections to the land and who they are. That's why I've always believed it's very important to carry on our traditions and our culture as Native peoples, to make sure our children know who they are and have that identification with the sacredness of our Mother Earth. Native peoples, especially those who are trying to practice the ways that have been given to them since time immemorial, are an endangered species. Acculturation and assimilation, which are the products of colonization, have been very effective. As Native peoples, we're still trying to hang on to what little we have left, our language, so we can practice our ceremonies and our sacred areas. Western forms of development have gradually destroyed many of those sacred places. The elders tell us that we're a tribal society of givers living in a society of takers. They say, go and do what you can to talk to the people, try and educate them about these things. In the Native way, we restrict people's own spirits. They have to come through their own self-realization, take responsibility for their actions. A meeting of the tribes. Unfortunately, non-Native peoples no longer have traditional tribal systems, so we can't meet with them tribe to tribe. This is how we used to deal with these kinds of issues. There were always ceremonial leaders, women leaders, mechanisms for approaching these things, but that's not there anymore. Tribalism has been killed off. As a practitioner of our traditional ways, I've been taught to put prayer first, to put the sacred pipe first. These teachings provide me with the discipline to put the Creator first in everything I do. When I don't put the Creator first, then I start getting into trouble. I was taught that when we're given a mind and a heart, and when we start to use the mind too much, we get out of balance. We have to maintain a balance. Anytime I put prayer aside and try to do paperwork or do politics too much, I get myself in trouble. In our traditional societies, we had political leaders, but political leaders maintained a balance with the spiritual leadership in the village. Various tribes had clan mothers or matrilineal clan systems that kept the menfolk in check. Our connection with the sacredness of the female creative principle of Mother Earth really means a lot, and that's something a lot of people don't understand. We always say that Mother Earth is sacred. She's the creative principle that allows life to go on, and that's why in our traditional values as native peoples, we have the most respect and reverence for the female. We're taught to take care of the Mother Earth and to take care of our women, our mothers, our aunts, our grandmothers, our sisters, and our daughters in the same way we take care of the Earth. I need to say that there are many different tribes and many different ways, but there are many similarities that when I talk about the sacredness of Mother Earth and our relationship to the woman. Anytime we start to lose that understanding, that's when we start getting into trouble as men. Men have big egos. Men can easily lead religions and societies into warfare. That's why we always have to take direction from our women, from our matrilineal clan systems, because they understand the importance of that relationship. That was always the balance. The men's role is also very important. The man is the protector of our villages and our women. I think that the men's and women's roles are out of balance in the same way that life is out of balance right now. I believe that men have to somehow find out what our role is in the modern world. The woman still carries forth the children, still understands the creative principle that has that connection to the earth and the powers of the moon. Their role is more easily defined. But I find a lot of brothers, no matter what race, are out of balance, searching for who they are as men. We must not forget that Father Sky and Mother Earth need one another as part of the creative principle. That goes back to the work we do with the environment. When I talk to white environmentalists about the importance of the spiritual aspects of their work, they have no understanding of that, especially the men. The women seem to have a better understanding. Very often, the closest that non-natives can understand about the sacredness of Earth is the concept of stewardship. What is good, which is good but still has ownership attached to it. But we can work with stewardship as a beginning. Sharing ceremonies. A lot of the prophecies of the various tribes have said the time will come when the younger brother and the younger sister who have come across the ocean will start to look towards the native peoples for direction. But in my younger years, I was very resistant to the New Agers coming into our lands and into our ceremonies. My youth led me into native activism, what we call red power. I was one of those foot soldiers demanding the recognition of our treaty rights with my fists in the air, demanding justice. I talked to my grandmother once, and she said, "You've got a lot of anger in you. What's wrong?" So I started talking about what was going wrong, about people being killed. She said, "You need to go into ceremony. You've got a lot of anger." As the years went on, I started to see more non-native people, especially white people, coming to our ceremonies looking for answers, and I struggled with that. It seemed to me they were continuing the same old practice of taking things away from us without giving back. Now it was our ceremony and our knowledge. An uncle on the Dakota Reservation in Prairie Island, Minnesota, asked me to help him with the sweat lodge in the mid-1980s. He had a dream that the four colors of man would be coming to his ceremonies. Sure enough, soon people started coming down from the Twin Cities on Friday nights, carloads of them, and there I was helping him with all those people. I couldn't have done it if he hadn't asked, but he needed help. He was getting tired. I really had to work this out for myself because I couldn't take my anger into the sweat lodge. I started to learn about compassion. I feel people in this country as well as in Europe are searching. I've been to a German sweat lodge, which was given to them by a full-blooded Cherokee man in the 1970s. Last year in Germany, I was sitting in the sweat lodge with these German people. They said they had lost their ways from the Crusades a long time ago, and this native sweat lodge was all they had to help them make their way back to who they were. I saw they had respect and humility about these spiritual ways. They demonstrated compassion for each other, love and faith in the higher power. They have everything that they need to live and survive. Who's to say what they're doing is wrong? I started to see that this spiritual understanding is to be shared with all people, regardless of race. Back in the 1980s, I met some people with the Rainbow Tribe. The Rainbow Tribe is mostly white folks, but there were some black people, Latinos, and Asians. I had my own stereotypes about the Rainbow Tribe, basically hippie-type folks who smoked marijuana, partied, and tried to have a connection with the earth. I thought there was something out of balance, and I usually stayed away from the rainbow gatherings. But I met some elders who came to the ceremonies that my uncle was running at the Prairie Island Dakota Reservation. I sat down and talked with them. I learned they didn't want to be disrespectful to Native peoples or our ways. They talked about the importance of keeping things in context and not mixing things up. They understood. They said there was no structure in the Rainbow Tribe to address this. They do the best they can. Basically, they allow different people to do what they want to do. I started to pray about that, and understanding came to me that God is very compassionate and loving to everyone. When people start coming together searching for answers for themselves, like the Rainbow Tribe, if they are sincere and have patience, a way will come to them that is for them. It may not be Native as we define it, but it is something that comes in a sacred manner, and it will be for them. That is the power of this creation working through all people of all races and all tribes. It is my prayer that when all humans go through this transformation, it will help them to re-identify their relationship to the sacredness of the land, Mother Earth. When this comes, we will have a peace and a clean and a safe future for our future generations. And the writer of that was Tom B.K. Goldtooth, who's a Diné and a Mequon Dakota. He's the national director of the Indigenous Environmental Network. If you'd like to contact them, they can be reached at P.O. Box 485, Bemidji, Minnesota, 56619. That's the Indigenous Environmental Network, P.O. Box 485, Bemidji, Minnesota. That's B-E-M-I-D-J-I, Minnesota, 56619. Or you can try phoning them at 218-751-4967. That's 218-751-4967. Or you can try going to their webpage at www.ienearth.org. That's www.ienearth.org, Indigenous Environmental Network, earth.org. They have a calendar of recent events, news, and announcements of gatherings that are going on. It's very nice. And we want to thank Rachel's Environmental and Health News, issue number 739, for this commentary. You can find Rachel's Environment and Health News at www.rachel.org. That's another great environmental news source to support. What do you got for us, J-Man?
All right, Uncle Dennis, I got a lot of good animal stories here. Check this out. Congress considers banning canned hunts. Representative Sam Farr, a California Democrat, has introduced the House version of a bill to ban so-called canned hunts of exotic animals. The Captive Exotic Animal Protection Act would make it illegal to shoot exotic animals within fenced enclosures for trophies. Last month, Senator Joe Biden, a Delaware Democrat, introduced a Senate version of the bill. Proprietors of canned hunts charge hundreds of thousands of dollars for clients to shoot exotic animals such as Cape buffaloes, Corsican rams, gazelles, and black buck antelopes. The animals are often tame and accustomed to people, sometimes from zoos or circuses, and do not flee from the hunters. Most operations guarantee success, advertising as no kill, no pay. There is no sport in shooting a tame animal trapped behind a fence for a guaranteed trophy, said Diana Norris, grassroots coordinator for animal welfare group The Fund for Animals. Because of the patchwork of state laws loosely regulating the trade in exotic animals, this legislation is a much-needed remedy to protect captive animals from becoming trophies at canned hunts. Several states ban or restrict canned hunts, but there are no laws that prohibit the sale of exotic animals from those states to others in which canned hunts are legal. The bills now before Congress would ban the interstate sale or transfer of exotic animals for the purpose of killing or injuring them within fenced enclosure for trophies or recreation. Wildlife advocates, biologists, and even hunters are working together to stop this unsporting and unsavory practice, said Heidi Prescott, National Director of the Fund. Canned hunts are creating health risks to domestic animals and native wildlife populations, are detrimental to the public image of all hunters, and are erroneously cruel and inhumane. The Fund for Animals recently published a report, Canned Hunts, Unfair at Any Price, which analyzes the laws and regulations governing canned hunts in all 50 states. For more information, check out on the web at www.cannedhunts.com. That's CANNEDHUNTS.com. And that was brought to us by the Environment News Service. Here, happening in Kenya, we have some good animal supporters helping out. Kenya arrests two suspected rhino horn traders. The Kenya Wildlife Service, the KWS, said it had arrested one person in possession of three fresh-looking rhino horns 2 weeks after poachers killed four endangered black rhinos in southern Kenya. A second person was arrested on suspicion of storing the horns at his home. KWS said in a statement, four black rhino carcasses were found stripped of their horns in Sasavo National Park late November. It was the first time in 8 years that poachers had ventured inside one of Kenya's national parks to attack the endangered species. The Kenya Wildlife Service said it had arrested one person at a hotel in the coastal resort of Mombasa last week afternoon. The suspect arrived at Mombasa Hotel in a hired taxi, where he was to sell his wares, when the Kenya Wildlife Service personnel pounced on him and arrested him. This has led to the arrest of another suspect in whose house the horns had been hidden. Kenya's black rhino population has fallen to about 460 from an estimated 20,000 in 1970, mainly due to poaching. Authorities have managed to control poaching more recently by concentrating the rhinos in smaller areas, making it easier to protect them. The KWS said Africa's black rhino numbers have fallen dramatically in the last 3 decades. The population of 65,000 in the 70s has dwindled to around 2,700, mainly concentrated in Kenya, Zimbabwe, South Africa, Namibia, and Zambia. As from the Reuters News Service, you got one more. Poachers threaten survival of Cambodian species. Cambodian poachers killed about 100 wild elephants, tigers, leopards, and rare bears in the past 18 months, threatening the survival of those species in the country, conservationists said yesterday. The numbers of endangered animals killed by hunters make poachers the main threat to the survival of Cambodia's dwindling elephant and tiger populations. In this rate of poaching continues, elephants and tigers will be extinct in the foreseeable future, said Hunter Weiler of the U.S.-based Cat Action Treasury, that's the CAT. At the current rate of attrition, these species may not be biologically viable in 3 to 5 years, he told Reuters at his office. A total of 225 large mammals were killed in 3 of Cambodia's 24 provinces between May 2000 and October 2001, according to a new report compiled by Cat Wildlife Rangers. The animals killed included 26 elephants, 20 tigers, 3 leopards, 47 bears, and over 100 wild deer and other species, the report said. Weiler said the number of large animals killed in Cambodia's remaining 21 provinces would push the nationwide total higher. Elephant and tiger body parts are highly prized for use in traditional Chinese medicine, and poachers can earn large sums for the trade. Deer are also popular food and medicinal purposes. Experts estimate between 300 and 600 wild elephants still live scattered in remote parts of Cambodia. The country's tiger population is estimated to be even lower. Cambodia has laws to protect endangered animals, but 3 decades of civil war, including the 1970s Khmer Rouge killing fields regime, has left the country poor and the judicial system open to corruption. Arresting poachers is also difficult, as many illegal hunting operations involve police and military personnel. The Slovak tortoise poachers convicted in South Africa. Yes! Two Slovak nationals caught in South Africa with 113 angulate tortoises in their possession have been convicted under the Nature Conservation Ordinance due to the work of Cape Nature Conservation's new Green Crime Unit. They could receive an unprecedented fine in excess of 1 million rand, that's 91,000 U.S. Martin Kainz and Martin Jurik were apprehended between Garfwater and Lamberts Bay on November 14th when they were observed collecting a tortoise on the roadside. Police then discovered two suitcases filled with 113 of the rare tortoises. Angulate tortoises, distinguished by the reddish color of their underside of their shells, are protected under Nature Conservation Ordinance, according to the West Cape Nature Conservation Board. Accordingly, no tortoise or tortoise eggs or tortoise parts such as a shell may be collected from the wild, possessed, imported, or exported without a permit. This smallish tortoise prefers sandy coastal regions and is usually confined to the Cape and southern Namibia. The tortoises are presently at Tyburg Zoo, where they are recuperating. Yes, they're living. Cape Nature Conservation has recently formed an environmental crime unit in partnership with other organizations, a group of officials whose sole responsibility is to prevent, investigate, and monitor green crime. We should get that here. Frenard Fanny Becker, Cape Nature Conservation's Director of Operational Services, said, "The huge success that we have recently enjoyed is substantial proof of the necessity of a strategic rather than ad hoc approach to environmental crime. We will no longer tolerate the illegal exploitation of our heritage, and the recent firm stance taken by the courts accentuates the fact that South Africa's image as a soft target for environmental crime is rapidly changing. Thank you, Environment News Service."
All right, and that's all the time we have for news. To get news or announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, send us email. Our email address is cruzeif@cruzeio.com. That's cruzeif@cruzeio.com. Or you can send us letters. Our address, Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Once again, that's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Be sure to send those announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. If you want more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. That's a publication that comes out 8 times a year. Their address, P.O. Box 3023, Tucson, Arizona, 85702. Once again, that's the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 3023, Tucson, Arizona, 85702. You can listen to Earth First Radio live on your computer every Thursday night at 8 p.m. Actually, you can only do that one more time, and that's a week from tonight. You can go to the website at www.microradio.net/FRSC and listen in. That's www.microradio.net/FRSC. Starting January 1st, Earth First Radio will be heard at 5:30 every afternoon during the week, Monday through Friday at 5:30. There's lots of great shows on Free Radio Santa Cruz, so listen anytime. You can always find Earth First Radio archived shows on the World Wide Web at www.radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. Or you can try going to www.la.indiemedia.org. That's www.la.indiemedia.org. And search for Earth First Radio. I say try at LA Media because I hear that their hard drive is full and they don't have any more room for Earth First Radio. Oh well, this was show number 170. Earth First Radio is carried on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. Please tell your local radio station that Earth First Radio format is going to be changing to a 5-minute, 5-day-a-week show, and it's still going to be free. This show was produced by the Earth First Radio Collective in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Helping me tonight was J-Man. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney from the CD Keep It Wild. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening to Earth First Radio. And now we're going to listen to Casey Neal off his first CD called Riff Raff. This song is called Dancing on the Ruins.
Multinational corporations dancing on the ruins of multinational corporations, dancing on the ruins of multinational corporations. Ha, 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 ha. Say goodbye to plastic and goodbye to cars. No more convenience stores. wars. Hello to stars. No more Wall Street and no more Pentagon. Thinking about these things makes me happy. We're dancing on the ruins of multinational corporations. Dancing on the ruins of multinational corporations. Dancing on the ruins of multinational corporations. Ha, ha, ha. Styrene will put into the waste. There is no time for debating. We have to make haste. If we're going to survive without computer program minds, we're going to have to can pop culture. And say hello to campfires and stomping bare feet and naked amoebas hungry to eat. Hello to primal consciousness and love for the land now that coyotes are running the country. Multinational corporations. Ha, 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 ha. Sayonara to suburbia and well-manicured lawns. Bye-bye Barbie and Ken doll pawns. No more developers or slime ball execs. Your condos are on fire. Multinational corporations. Ha, 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 ha. No more a Christian country will have pagan deities. And when we've destroyed technology, we all will be free. The pavement will be ripped up and the skyscrapers cut down. Yes, we are coming for your children.